This is...
Wow! What a week.
What a week. Politics.
Hey, Tom, Dumelang, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. My name is Fresh, his name is Botsang Modimo wa me Moiloa, and this is another installation of Wow, What a Week, hashtag Polytrix. Botsang.
Good morning, Tato, and the viewers from all over the world.
Okrend.
As you said, depending what time is it in the part of the globe.
Absolutely.
And I'm okay, my brother.
I think let's jump straight into it. The Democratic Alliance and the African National Congress seem to be going back and forth like an old couple. It's a new marriage, but they're carrying on like an old couple.
Well, when old people get married at a late age in life, this is what happens.
Yeah, because they're both set in their ways.
Exactly.
And another one is willing to compromise.
And nobody's willing to accept that in a marriage you compromise.
But there's also a saying that generally the first 2 years of marriage are probably going to be your biggest fights.
Well, if this married couple will last 2 years, the way things are going, I think they should just tolerate each other.
Sure. So what's happening? What's the underlying issue?
Well, it all started about 2-3 weeks back when President Ramaphosa, signed or enacted the bill of the Bella Bill into law, and subsequently late last week, when our show was on air, it was announced, ironically, when the president was out of the country in Davos. And it was reported by the president that he had signed the expropriation bill into an act of parliament.
Now. Okay.
So I don't know whether he signed before he left or he signed outside the country, if that is legal. But how ironic that it was announced when the president was out of the country. He was in Switzerland, and it was announced last week Friday by the presidency.
But surely he would have signed it before he left then.
So why sign and run away and not face? Why don't you sign to can face your partner in bed, the Democratic Alliance, and 10 others afresh? Because I've noted that it is not only the Democratic Alliance that is lamenting on this whole thing.
In fact, the Minister of Arts and Culture, Gayton McKenzie, of the Patriotic Alliance, says that Ramaphosa stabbed us in the back by signing the Expropriation Act.
Yeah, but I think he dribbled them instead of stepping them at the back. And I'll come to Gayton. Let me start with the Democratic Alliance.
Okay, help me understand this. Because for this bill to have been signed to be an act, it would have gone through every hurdle and hoop in parliament.
Absolutely. Not only in parliament, there's a whole lot of process.
Oh, yes. There's also the NCOP.
The National Council of Provinces.
Yes.
So the two houses of parliament.
Sure.
It must go through them, which is the NCOP, as well as the National Assembly.
So the point I'm making is every single member of parliament and party would have had an opportunity to give their opinions.
Absolutely.
To make their submissions.
Yes.
To complain if there's anything to complain about. So it was at the final stage where we've been having this song and dance for however many years it took. Why is it an issue that he signed it when they knew it was coming?
This is the issue.
Yeah.
For first of all, that process you mentioned of going through the National Assembly, then back into the NCOP, then for public consultations as well, because there's public consultation. It must be gazetted for public comments and inputs. It went through that. All that process, including the National Assembly debating and voting on the bill, happened in the previous administration. And that's where the challenge is.
But why is it a challenge?
It happened. It's
because surely, this is like a marriage with an ANC.
Yes.
Pardon the pun. You know what I mean? So
exactly
we're in community of property with a Kruan.
Yeah. So this is actually a marriage with the ANC, not the political party, the anti-nuptial contract. So the anti-nuptial contract was there dealt with, signed, dealt by the parliament.
Yes.
And it just waited for the pastor to come and sign that marriage certificate,
exactly,
which was President Ramaphosa, authorizing the marriage.
Hence, I don't understand the big deal.
The remember, parties like, for example, who are now in government, like the Patriot Alliance, and that's where Katie McKenzie comes in, they were not part of the government in the sixth administration.
Sure.
So they have a feeling like they should be conservative since they are now part of the government, which is incorrect because putting a signature on a bill that has went through the process, the president is doing what actually the constitution of the country prescribes.
Absolutely.
And it is the Democratic Alliance that is always lamenting and talking about the rule of law, adherence to the law and matters like that. Now Ramaphosa has adhered to the law, and we'll come to the meat of the act itself or the bill. But well, let's talk processes. So, you know, they say in Afrikaans, let's lag for the train. They are too late. The train has moved on. The ship has sailed, and they want to lament. I don't understand why would the Democratic Alliance, which formed part of the previous government as the official opposition, they voiced their voice in parliamentary process, which was well within the democratic process of the country and within the prescripts of the law, want the president to break or to divert and step away from the law in order to accommodate them now that they are in marriage with the ANC in ruling the country. So they are actually asking the president. That's why they are not rushing to court, because they know that it will not hold water. And you know, Fresh, what I've said to the people before regarding the signed agreement, the memorandum of intent towards the government of national unity, I've always said that document has no legal binding. You know, it is as useless as the ink and the paper that was used to write. It has no legal binding. There is no law in the Republic of South Africa or behavior or conduct that supersedes the supreme law of the country, which is the constitution. Now, if President Ramaphosa, whether we like it or not, goes and sign into law what has followed the constitutional process, why do you want to make noise about it? So that is the challenge. I think the DA were defeated in parliament by the African National Congress, supported by other political parties, and the right-wing political parties like the IFP, the DA, and the Freedom Front Plus, and the Reverend Meshwe's party, the ACDP, and all that. They opposed the expropriation of the land bill, but they were defeated in parliament, obviously. Sure. Now, what makes the matters complex? This is where the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, their leader is the head of the land, you know, a department in government. Now, and Gaten McKenzie, ironically, when I read Gaten's statement to say President Ramaphosa stepped them at the back, I asked myself, why is he saying that? Because there's a video clip that is making rounds where he was interviewed in one of the podcasts. And he mentioned how other countries like, like Estonia, like, you know, Alaska, and other countries with minerals are using their minerals to plow back into the nation, like distribution of resources.
Sure.
And now here's an act of parliament that, in my view, it will not deliver the same to us, but he is now saying the president has stabbed them at the back. How so? He's supposed to be jumping like otherwise. Where does he think he will get the land to can launch and do what is dreaming of, what you call it, the spinning as well as the Formula One, if we don't have land? The government needs land to create an environment for spinning to take place. He needs land as the Minister of Transport for spinning to take place. He's not going to do it in the sea or the air. Those spinning vehicles have to be on the ground. But first, before you come in, my concern does the spat between the two political parties.
Yes.
Especially the Minister of Public Works.
Yes.
There's a disjuncture there, and I'll talk, you know, with authority from the public service background.
What was this him saying that there'll be no expropriation on his watch?
Under his watch, And he went on spot on X with his deputy, Minister Zikalala. The Minister of Public Works, and I don't know why is the ANC-led GNU is giving these powers to the Minister of Public Works. We all know that public works is the landlord of government. It is managing the assets of government in terms of buildings and some infrastructure to some extent.
Yes.
For example, it's not all the infrastructure. For example, they don't manage the agricultural land because we have the Ministry of Agriculture and all that. They don't manage the mines and minerals which the government may expropriate. So I don't know why is it the public works minister, because it's only limited to public works facilities like buildings.
So what's on the land?
What is on the land?
Yes.
Not the land itself. Sure. You understand? And again, we have to redefine what is land. Land is not only the land where you build houses. Mm. For example, land that it can be allocated to the Human Settlement Department to build the so-called RDP houses or low-cost housing. Public works will have nothing to do with that. I had actually expected that the PAC leader in the GNU, who is responsible for land affairs, will be given the responsibility to make sure that this bill is being rolled out. Not the public works, not the landlord. You understand? Let's lose logic. There's someone who owns a building.
Are you saying he's overstepping?
He's overstepping, and I don't know why he's allowed to do that. I don't know why does he think that the expropriation of land bill resides with public works.
But isn't it part of how the DA operate anyway? I mean, I think he's right on brand, because banale arrogance nyana ya go overstep, and also of being alarmist.
Yes.
Because there's almost this impression being given that they're going to just come to your house, butsang, and take your house.
Exactly. No, and you
and,
see.
And in fact, this bill aside, this act aside, my understanding is expropriation could happen under the Constitution anyway.
And the Constitution makes provision for that.
Absolutely.
Other day we had a discussion on how the retired Justice Musinike, after his retirement, mentioned on why are South Africans not exercising their Bill of Rights within the Constitution to expropriate land.
It's there.
But also, I come in and say, this bill, actually, I think you are right when you say the Democratic Alliance are alarmist. I've read the bill. I've critiqued it. I'm one of the people who made comments over it yesterday. Fresh where I'm sitting, I can tell our followers and viewers, this bill is actually useless. It will not redistribute land the way land was expropriated from the African people by the apartheid regime. And I'll explain why. There are limitations. It's the same negotiated political settlement that happened during the Kwadesa negotiations to say, before you expropriate the land, and it's not without compensation. We have to correct that. It is expropriation of land with compensation.
Absolutely.
Because the government must approach the landowner and say, you've got this unutilized land. First, the land must be unutilized or the property, whatever. And secondly, even if it's underutilized, because I've used unutilized, then there's underutilized, or the government is in dire straits need for that land. An example is when the Gautrain.
I was going to say, we need to build a freeway.
We need to,
and it needs to go through here.
And I'll use one example that I've been in government since 1993.
Yeah.
Since 1993, the government has been planning to upgrade the Moloto Road, the killer road between Tshwane and Mpumalanga, Kwamhlanga and Mpumalanga.
Yes.
One of the reasons, to put a rail line there, one of the reasons the government could not do that for over 30 years, I found that project in government, it is because the farm owners along that corridor, Moloto corridor, did not want to make land available, even if the farms are underutilized, or even to allow the government to put a rail line that could have saved lives and reduced congestion on the Moloto Road.
Yeah, because the less trucks,
there's less trucks on the road. There'll be a train that is ferrying people and goods between, because there's a lot of people moving. People were refusing, or landowners or farmers, whoever. And the same model that the government applied when we had the Gautrain being launched in Gauteng. Government approached landowners. Some were houses, some were shops. People were bought out or offered money to move. This is what this expropriation is talking about. But for me, it is defeating the formation of the liberation struggle in South Africa, where the ANC talked Maibuye, where the PAC talked Izweletu, and all those things. We are focusing on soft targets of the land. We are focusing on unutilized, what I call useless land.
Are you saying there's still an elephant in the room and no one is willing to actually
deal with it? And that's where I come in, that they must first negotiate, then they must pay and buy. If they fail, the court, most of this will be resolved in court. The act makes provision to go for litigation, to go to court. The court must rule. Now, you are still negotiating. you are willing to pay. It's, we are back at willing buyer, willing seller.
Yes.
We are willing to pay. If they are not willing, you can take them to court and the court must rule. But which land are we talking about? Land where government want to build a highway, they want to build a rail line, they want to build houses, and whatever need may be for, it could be for agricultural land. What are we saying about profitable economic land that is in the hands of one foreign settlers in South Africa, the so-called foreign direct investors, as well as land that was expropriated from the African people, which is the mineral land, the mines,
yes,
that are owned by the De Beers, the Anglo-American and the Ashantis and the Japanese mining companies all over the Northwest, the platinum mines, you know, because that's part of the land. What are we saying about that? What is the government saying? The government is sitting in a position whereby we are lacking revenue in our resources. They are borrowing from the IMF and the World Bank. The U.S. has just announced that they are going to cut some of the grants to us that were coming to South Africa through the U.S. aid. The government needs money. The Republic of South Africa has lent vast majority of minerals, and whether it's platinum, gold, diamonds, uranium, copper, whatever. We have it. Why don't we expropriate that land for the benefit? Remember, the act says for the benefit of the government to can be able to feed and sustain the nation. Now, the government needs money to can buy ARVs that America has been buying or funding for us. So why don't we expropriate the mines that were taken from the African people, whether through force during colonialism or through apartheid laws? You understand? So if you have an act of parliament that is afraid to can touch and rattle and expropriate land, I mean, the other day in on the show, I mentioned how over 70% of the dams that are supplying water that is being consumed in South Africa, or the reservoirs that are carrying the water that you are consuming in Gauteng, 70% of it, it's not me who's saying it, is the report from the Department of Water Affairs and Sanitation. It's white male Afrikaner owned. That's what the report is saying. Why don't we expropriate those dams from those people? Because water, it's a need, it's a necessity, and the government can go and distribute water at a much more cheaper, unlike profits, to the people.
Sure.
Because those who are in business of selling water, whether they sell it directly to us or sell it to the government, they are there for business and nothing else, and they want to make profit. So for me, this Section 25 amendment and expropriation of the Land Act with compensation.
Sure.
Parties like, I don't know, what is the PAC going to say, which is in the government? The EFF has been very clear on this matter. Umkhonto is a party there, and you haven't really heard their voices in parliament regarding expropriation. But I think, going back to politics, I think the DA is very silly. I think they want the ANC to break the law, and they are forgetting that they are in government at the behest of the President of the Republic. I'm a critic. I'm one of the people who says this bill will not say, but if the President has followed processes, or if the government has followed processes to have this bill to be enacted as an act of parliament, why is the Democratic Alliance having a problem with that? They want to be babysitted fresh. They are not babies in this. They're in government. They must start governing. But I still want to hear, and I'm raising a question that I haven't seen anything. It just crossed my mind when I've been listening to, is it Dr. McPherson or something like that?
Or Dean McPherson.
Dean McPherson. Yeah. When I've been listening, I was asking myself, what does he has to do? You see what it does, this bill? It limits land ownership to property ownership. And property, land is not just a mere property. The sea, the rivers, the mountain. I mean, I've said several times, the people of Langa, Khayelitsha, Guguletu, majority of them, I can bet, over 95,000, they've never been on top of the Table Mountain because it has been privatized. Because it's money to get up there. And they can't afford to pay over 300 rand to get up there. While that mountain, and it's actually the contract, I know it's finishing this year, 2025. It's supposed to belong to the government, to the people. But the people can't go there and enjoy the beauty, the God-given beauty of the Table Mountain.
But how is there no subsidization of locals to visit some of these areas? Surely if you have a South African identity, you should be able to go up Table Mountain without paying if you can't afford it.
Exactly, if you can't afford it. Now, we have been screaming about that, Fresh. Let me tell you what Sanparks does once a year.
Mm.
Sanparks once a year, they've got this Know Your Country project where South African, you know, ID holders can free for just one day visit.
It's like an open day.
An open day, yeah. But I've made an example and I've made recommendations. When I served in the committee that formed the Border Management Authority, there were officials from various government departments. One of the recommendations I've made to, and based on experience, to the Environmental Affairs, that time it was controlling, you know, our tourism. I said, in Rwanda, for example, you know that famous gorilla mountains in Rwanda?
Yes.
When I was stationed in Kigali, you know what the police did, the RPF, Rwanda Patriotic Front, passed immediately when they came into power? If you were a Rwandese to go into that park, it was $2.
Mm.
If you were an African, it was, I think, $5 to $10, depending whether you are from the East Africa region or not. If you were a foreigner, like from Europe and Asia, it was $200.
Yeah.
So they made provision to say these national parks belong to the Rwandese.
And that's what it should be, though, because, I mean, they're part of your heritage.
Yes.
As a South African, you should be, and nobody's saying it must be free access.
No.
But it must be dirt cheap for a citizen to visit any national park in any country.
Especially national parks or heritage sites that are in the proximity of the residents.
I'm a part of this community, but I can't even enjoy my own heritage.
Exactly. And that's the problem.
Kimotom Pumalanga, but I can't even afford to go into half of these areas that are reserved for tourists.
Exactly.
Like, how does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense. And this is the challenge. This is where I'm challenging this expropriation of land bills and acts. They are not distributing the resources to the people. And distributing is not giving people money and telling people, go, you can go into the so-called Kruger Park and start hunting and eating the meat. No, no, no. Make me and my kids go and enjoy what is a zebra and see that, because I don't have money. I'm a real, especially, and you can use the social services database. You understand? To say these people are already on social grants. The kids are going to school based on free education because their parents can afford. But these kids have never been inside the Kruger Park. They've never been to the Table Mountain. They've never been, you know, anywhere in the heritage sites of this world. I grew up in the West Rand, and there used to be school trips to go to the Cradle of Humankind.
Yes.
I only afforded to go there when I was working, which was 20 kilometers away from my home because my family could not afford me to go to the Cradle of Humankind. And again, this is where we are failing the nation. We are passing beautiful laws. They sound good. They excite foreign investors as well as the DA. But if I was the DA, I wouldn't get excited over this. I would not, because it's not going to rattle them. The government has no money to can buy that land. Even if they raise money, my biggest fear actually is not even if they raise. Even if they raise money, they have messed up so much that they will mess up even the land they will expropriate. You know, the government has demonstrated to us that it is not incapable of running the affairs, business affairs of government. That the corruption in the government system has made the government to look incompetent. And now these people are going to expropriate land to do what? To distribute to the people. They failed to distribute simple, basic township RDP houses for over 30 years. And we want to, and they failed the SOEs of government, and we want to add more. People are failing, you want to add more into their basket. When we expropriate land as a nation, I've always maintained that we have to expropriate profitable land. Now we are going to rely on courts. Trust me, most of these cases will have to go to court for courts to rule that the government can have that land. And it's going to be simple. It's going to be, that's why McPherson is so excited. It's going to be all these dilapidated buildings that are lying around the cities. You understand? And the ANC goes and responds. But the response of the ANC was bold, to say the DA must not come and play as if they are the only ones in government, then we must break the law or bend in order to accommodate them. Because they had their press conferences one after the other.
Yes. Because for me, it would be a different story if all of this had happened during the GNU. Mm-hmm. This was a done deal.
Yeah, that's a done deal.
It just needed the president's signature.
Yes,
that's all it needed.
And this is again where the procrastination is a problem.
Sure.
There is absolutely no reason for President Ramaphosa to have delayed in signing this into law. Mm. Unlike the Bela Act, remember, he still consulted or needed to consult with the new partners in the GNU, the wife or the spouse and the children and the stepkids and all that. He needed to consult with them. The expropriation bill, there was never consultation after it passed. There was never that process that the Bela bill went through. So he could have signed this law, this act or bill into law long before the GNU was established, even after, you know, or before the elections, the 2024 general or national elections, because this was long past. But again, it shows the delay. The delay, it has costed this stress. But I don't think the ANC and President Ramaphosa care these days. What they are doing very well with the DA is they just ignore them. Mm. They just do their
Baba manager.
Yeah, no, they're managing them. The DA is being managed. I was listening to Gogo Zilli during the course of the week, lamenting and crying. And that's why, and I think they are realizing, the members of the GNU, I think they are realizing that their agreement is a useless agreement. Sure. It doesn't hold water.
But also they've tasted the crack. And it's nice.
Yeah, no.
So they don't want to now deny themselves access to the crack.
I said, no matter the differences between these political parties, especially the DA and the ANC, the DA will not leave this GNU.
And also because the DA, they pride themselves in being the prefect in Yana.
Yes.
So they don't want to leave the classroom.
Yeah, no. You can't leave the classroom. The other students...
The class monitor.
Yeah.
You see, so because they position themselves as the class monitor, they know they can't afford to leave the classroom.
Yeah, and something surprised that came out of the... well, people say it's not the first time they did this, but for me it came as a surprise. You know, they are from the 1st of March, they are launching their campaign towards 2026. Mm. And in their press conference, they announced that their mayor candidates, particularly, you know, Helen Zille was very clear, particularly in Gauteng, it's going to be open for everybody.
Yes.
And ask yourself why particularly in Gauteng. Because they know that they will never win Gauteng as they wish. Look, they're out of the three metros of Gauteng at the moment, the major metros. Why not in the Western Cape?
Yeah, why can't they open it up?
Why would not? Oh, yeah, because they are now saying even non-members of the DA, like me, I can raise my hand and apply. You apply to be a mayoral candidate.
Yeah, because they say they're looking for only the best.
Only the best. But how on earth... let's take...
But why would you hire for what is already working?
Oh, what do you mean?
As in, if it's working already in the Western Cape, the engine is working.
Yeah.
Why do we need to overhaul it?
No, in the Western Cape, remember, they've been in power for long, and they hired. I think they went through that process, but it was not open to everybody.
Yes.
They always advertise.
But do you blame them, though? Because, like I said, the car is running.
Okay.
All 12 cylinders are firing.
Why do they think...
Why do we need an engine overhaul?
Okay, fine. Why do they think that where the engine is not working, like in Gauteng, a non-DA member, a non-subscriber to DA, let's say I qualify, let's say I apply and I qualify, I'm a non-subscriber to DA policies, which are neoliberal policies, if not right-wing policies. And I'm a best candidate to can be a male candidate of the city of Tshwane. Why do they think I will sit there with all those chains and ropes and implement their policies that I'm anti those policies? It's risky to do something like that.
I'm sure you'd be vetted still. I mean, it's not like they're going to hire someone that has been clearly anti-DA or pro-MK and ANC. They're still vetting.
I think this whole thing is a farce. I think they are trying to recruit people. It's a recruitment drive so that they can convert and convince people that the DA, it's not hiring, it's not applied, and we'll consider your application.
Are you saying they're just collecting a database?
They are collecting a database and see who's idling, who is not sure which political parties he belongs to, and they're going to approach those. We'll start getting those messages, you know, towards the elections. Vote DA and reminder to check if you are registered for votes. But look, it is their strategy. Maybe it has worked for them before. Different political parties have different strategies. And the ANC used to make parties. you know, in stadiums and all over in gala dinners. It worked for them to a certain extent. And yeah, but, you know, at least they are starting things. What I appreciate with the DA is their planning. When it comes to planning and doing things timeously, look, by 1st of March, they are launching their campaign for 2026. And we don't know when will the elections be, local government elections will be in 2026. But it's all just over a year.
Yeah.
Because they have to be after May 2026, if you recall when was the last elections of the LGE. So it's just over, and I think it's good planning and it's good time. And for that, we must give them credit.
Absolutely. I know this wasn't part of our plan for today. Mm-hmm. But remember when we discussed Janusz Baluszy's deportation back to Poland?
Oh, yes.
And
yes,
I've said that I'm waiting for the book and maybe the movie.
Yeah.
And then Annika Larsson, I think from ENCA, actually had an interview with him.
Yes, yes.
And he's still unrepentant. He talks about how, given a chance, he'd do it again.
Yeah.
He doesn't think black people have any business running any government. Yeah, he's unrepentant. He literally gave everyone a middle finger.
Yeah.
And I think in the process, also proving right everyone that said this guy should not be released. Because he's unremorseful.
Is he? How did he get...
He's not forthcoming with any information. He still insists that he was a lone gunman.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, he's literally saying Minister Lamola was right.
But you remember when you said that, what I said? I mentioned two things.
Yeah.
I said, one, I don't understand how was the guy granted parole.
Mm.
He was due for parole according to the laws of the country. But how was he granted parole when he refused? Because one of the requirements to be a parolee is that you must show remorse.
Sure.
You must show that you are sorry for what you have done.
Mm.
The guy never did. He has been consistent.
Mm.
And I was worried about it. Nonetheless, I vividly recall saying, I think this guy is going to go out and rattle the ruling party further and solve further divisions in the ruling party or their previous or even late people. One of the things, I didn't watch that whole interview because I actually got, you know, for lack of a better word, I got pissed off that I wasted my time watching part of it. But the moment he mentioned that they must go and ask Jacob Zuma, the former president, because he visited Clive Debo Lewis when he was in jail, that has nothing to do with him. It was about him and his actions and murdering of Ntate Chris Hani.
Mm.
And him mentioning Jacob Zuma in the process.
Mm.
He was trying to say to the black South Africans, actually, your own Zuma has been talking to us while we were in prison.
Mm.
And now the country is divided to say, why was Zuma visiting Clive David Lewis while he was in prison? The country is very divided. Was he selling out? Some were saying, but he was doing his duties as an ANC leader, trying to extract information from them, trying to figure out if they will at least tell the truth of what happened. But he went there out with nothing, you understand? But I think, you know what? The country must put a closed chapter on the Janusz Waluszy case. The guy has been paroled. We have spent our taxes to take him home. And he's comfortably in his country, and he's actually threatening us that, given another chance, he will kill another, you know, communist leader in South Africa or a leftist in South Africa.
Mm.
And look, he's old, and I think it's rhetorics, but I wouldn't be surprised that when a book comes or a movie or a soapy, whatever you call it, I think it will come with much more detail.
Sure.
I think they were testing the market now and see if people will be excited, and we did get excited.
But he says there's no reason to continue to look for a bigger story here to be used by members of the ANC against each other. He says, this is it. There's nothing more.
Like I said, let the sleeping dogs lie.
Mm.
You know, we won't get anything out of these people. And they were taken care of by the ANC-led government from the beginning to the end. There must be deep-rooted reasons why, and we'll probably, me and you, go to our graves without knowing what was actually behind and who else was involved in this process.
Sure.
I don't think that's going to come out anytime soon.
Mm.
Our great-grandchildren will read it in the history books years to come, not now.
Let's move to Davos, Switzerland, where about 50 world leaders converged for the World Economic Forum annual meeting.
Mm.
But a lot of people are saying Davos this year was a damn squib. And that there's, in the bigger scheme of things, it was just a talk shop and a waste of time and a waste of money, and that there were probably bigger stories that week.
Fresh, there's nothing to talk about in Davos except a bunch of world imperialists and capitalists gathering there to give instructions to political office bearers that they've put into power. Mm. Remember, it is the Oglo, what do you call them? You know, there's conglomerates and the Oglotarians of this world who are putting political people into power.
Sure.
They've put them into power. And I think it was overshadowed by President Trump taking over office. Mm. I think that's why there was no fanfare. Mm. There was nothing special to be discussed. And some of the matters that the people in Davos were sitting and discussing, Trump was acting in the U.S. against them. The U.S. is a bigger part of the G20. South Africa has taken up, what do you call it, has just taken up the leadership and the chairmanship of the G20.
Yeah.
The G20 is coming to South Africa next month. And let's hope that the foreign secretary of the U.S. will form part of the G20 despite the position, the heartland position that President Trump has taken towards the African continent, especially countries like South Africa that they've been trading and depending on a lot of U.S. aid. Mm. But there is nothing much that came out of Davos. But also what is causing that is that the world is changing. Because remember that Davos, they started by the business people, then the G7, then they brought some few developing countries, and now they've started taking Africa as a bunch of people that, to be led by South Africa. You know, as if Africa is one country. When it's suits the world. Africa is one country, it's one continent, it's united. It must come to the international forums as a united force. Mm. And when it suits the world, but when we want to unite to can challenge the world and guard our minerals and resources, the world will put money to divide us as a nation. You know, it's an African nation, but nothing for me to you know, to take home with Davos. It was just another waste of time, and they were puffing hot air. There's no tangible things. They have agreements, environmental agreements, and green, you know, environments, and all those things. But the same people who sit there and make those decisions to even help developing countries. How many years have we been talking about sustainability and development?
True.
Yes.
And I mean, in terms of geopolitics, I think, as always, it was the same old, same old. Russia versus Ukraine, peace in the Middle East.
In the Middle East.
And chances are Trump might manage to do more for those two conflicts than all of Davos did that week.
I am convinced the Donald Trump administration in the U.S. is going to do more on geopolitics and peace in the world, as well as economic development, than that bunch of people in Davos who were sitting there with their private jets. And I think the Trump administration will do more. And I'll tell you, he has already pushed President Vladimir Putin and President Zelensky to come to the table. Although President Putin is refusing to sit on one table with Zelensky, but Trump is pushing them. He has already given orders to Israel and Hamas and everybody that they are funding regarding peace in the Middle East. He has already cut funding a number of projects in Africa. And for me, people are saying, oh no, this is not good. It's very bad. I think it's a good thing.
But there's a judge who reversed it though.
There's a judge who reversed that. But others have been given. Let me tell you what happened in South Africa since the last 2 weeks. When Trump took over office, he already sent a circular or a note to all embassies. And unfortunately, in South Africa, they don't have an ambassador since your friend Bridget, the irritating guy, left.
Brigitte, yeah.
Yes, he left. So we don't have a U.S. ambassador to South Africa. And our ambassador is already taking a seat in Washington. Now, Donald Trump, and I hear this from the news, they had already sent a circular to the U.S. embassies, which were responsible for managing U.S. aid funds, $600 million in South Africa per annum, U.S. dollars. Yeah. One of the biggest benefactors, and I hear Dr. Motsoaledi reporting about it during the ANC conference yesterday, it was of the 52 districts where the country is distributing ARVs, 17 of those districts, of which 7 of them are in KZN due to the HIV and AIDS prevalence there. 17 of them were funded by the USAID through Wits University. The Wits University and other clinics, they had already received letters and notifications that they are not getting the money this month, not next month or what, this month they are not getting money, this end of January. You know, I've heard some of the benefactors of the HIV program sponsored by the USA, they even received SMSs to say your drugs, or what you call them, your ARVs, that you have been receiving from this particular clinic that was being administered and funded by the USAID, you are no longer going to go there and get them for free. Your government must do something. Understand? So some of the people are saying it's a negative thing. No. The USAID has been funding this project of HIV and AIDS in South Africa since the 90s, Fresh. What have we done? And I heard Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi saying it is 446 billion rands that they are spending on this project.
Sure.
17% of it
is from the U.S.
It's from the U.S. We have done very well as a country, I must say, to cover almost way more than half of it. You know, 17%, it's nothing. So we have covered almost what? About 77 or 73% of it. We have done very well. But for the U.S. to stand up and say, we are not funding you anymore. Go and help your own self. What's wrong with that? That's where self-reliance comes in. And who said as a nation we can't bring these pharmaceuticals to the table now? These medical aid companies that are milking the people to say, can you now help us fund this project? Because it is in the best interest of medical insurances to make sure that their members do not suffer.
Absolutely.
But the majority of the people who probably in the country are on ARVs, most probably it's people without even medical aid.
Sure.
So it is going to put a strain in the government.
Maybe it's because I always believe in every crisis is an opportunity. A crisis is not the end of the world. A crisis is not the sky is falling, let's all run and find cover somewhere. When the sky is falling, we all suffer.
Yes.
But for me, there's an opportunity here for us to, one, stop with this begging bowl mentality we have on the continent, where we have so many resources, but because we're badly led or resources are badly managed.
Yes.
We're always begging for money. We're begging for this. We're begging for that. At some stage, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror and say, you know what, actually, there's an indignity in always begging.
Begging, exactly.
When we have an opportunity to do for ourselves, to grow our people, and to, for once, give a middle finger to this culture of looting and eating.
Yeah, and Fresh, you are correct. You know, and when you speak of resources, one of the things we are gifted with in this country, when you look at the medical fraternity, is the skills. We also have the skills, not only the money and the minerals.
Some
and
of the brightest minds in this country.
Exactly, you understand? So it is time, that's why I'm challenging. You know, we have one of the best. Actually, the South African medical aid or scheme process, I've learned that it's way better than the U.S.
Yep.
You understand? The way it's administered and the way various medical schemes and funding schemes, they say it's way better than in the U.S. The government has just launched the, you know, an NHLS or LS. We can do it. There must be a political will in the country to say, let us be self-reliant. Let us give opportunities to companies and brands that are in the Republic of South Africa to do things for ourselves.
Absolutely.
Understand? And this reliance on the imperialists and former colonizers, if we don't act now under these strained circumstances and situation, there will be no other opportunity for us to end. So Trump is actually taking us to the river and leaving it there. How you swim, or you, whether you swim or you drink water while you are standing outside or whether in the river, it should be your own problem. Understand? Take, you know that old English saying, teach a person how to fish or to catch a fish. Understand? Don't just bring a prepared, clean, scrub fish on the table and expect that when that person has finished digesting and they're hungry again, they will wait for the fish to come to the table. You must teach the people how to fish. Then they must go and find the river and fish and feed themselves. And that's what Trump is saying to us. We can't be angry with the man for saying, I've been babysitting you since you were born. So we were born in 1994.
Now go out and find a job.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that he's right.
Now, you know, as much as you're saying there might be more peace in this Trump era than there's ever been on this earth.
Yep.
Unfortunately, he's also very brash in how he feels the U.S. is entitled to be about the U.S., even if it's at a cost to someone else. So, for instance, the way he's carrying on about Greenland, and that for security reasons, yes, they've got an army base in Greenland, amongst other things, that we must take over Greenland by hook or crook. Now the Danes are in a panic, and having meetings with NATO about this cyber rattling that Trump is doing. At what stage does someone say to Trump, yes, that's what you feel, but at a diplomacy level, we don't say things like that.
Who? When you say someone, who is that someone?
Melania, someone. after round dunyana, Melania must say, my darling.
That's not how you handle things. Now, first, that's, you know what Trump is doing? Again, your favorite word is the how. He's doing things. But if you look at Americans, all their presidents, they've been doing things and saying things that they were just a bit diplomatic. Barack Obama and Bill Clinton were a little bit diplomatic in the, but they were warmongers. We will go there, we'll smoke them out, we'll get Bin Laden, we'll bomb, we'll destroy Hamas, and they used those words.
But Trump is going for even allies, though.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
But Trump puts America first. There's no ally in politics. What Trump has proven, remember, some of the in inverted commas purported to be allies of the U.S., they actually, in some instances, worked against the U.S., you know, for their own interests and their own benefits. Look at how the French were very selfish in West Africa.
Yeah,
they never shared with the Americans. They actually made it difficult in West Africa for other so-called superpowers to penetrate the West African minerals and mining markets. And a typical example is how the French and the Belgians, which is a French-speaking country, they dominated the Great Lakes of Africa. And the Americans had to actually come behind the back door and fund some of the rebels or create rebel organizations in the area instead of challenging France directly and Belgium and other countries. Instead of challenging them directly to say, we want a share of that cake in West Africa or in the Great Lakes of Africa, we'll actually create a group of rebels that will unsettle in order to fight for the piece of the cake. But Trump is an economic person, he's a business person. He's doing it directly. That's why he can even say to friends, his friends, Russia and China are not enemies with the U.S. They trade very well, even under trade embargo at the moment, due to the Russia-Ukraine war. Under the trade embargo, Russia is still trading oil and other commodities like gas with the EU and the USA. So those are his friends. But look at what he says to them. And many people think the U.S. hates or is in a war with Russia and with China. They are not. If they are in a war, they would have stopped everything like they did with Zimbabwe. But they did not. They continue to trade with China. They are continuing to trade with Russia amid the laments, the noise, and the rhetorics of President Trump.
But I love how the EU are saying, we are ready to defend Greenland if we need
to.
So what peace are you talking about?
But
when already there's all this saber rattling happening?
Fresh, I can bet, I nearly said with something, but I can bet with my head on the block, there will never be a war between EU and the US in the next 100 years. It won't happen. No matter the sanctions and the tariffs and what, they are both, you know, have a lot to lose. And when it comes to militarily, the US alone will wipe up the EU. They will not do that. It's not in the best interest of their citizens. There are two nations that were built through colonialism and slavery. And they would rather go back to the Berlin Agreement and sit somewhere in Davos or wherever these days to say, how can we share this thing? They will negotiate better. If the US can't attack China, North Korea, Russia, and Iran militarily, why would you think they will attack France and small countries like Denmark and all that?
No, but this is, we will not let you take over Greenland the way you are claiming you're going to take it.
They will
even people in Greenland, 85% of Greenlanders are saying, we want nothing to do with America.
Yeah,
we want nothing to do with them.
They can talk, but they will go to, what I'm saying is, they will not fight. They will go to a negotiation table. they'll go into Portuguese.
But what we negotiate, you can't just come to a territory and say, okay, now we're here, you are mine.
Yeah, but if the Americans...
This is not 500 years ago.
If the Americans do to Greenland, look, they already have military base there.
Yeah.
If they go, then they take over and they enact it, what can the others do? They will keep on negotiating forever, like Israel and and by the way, it is the U.S. that took over Palestine. It's not Israel. It is the U.S. It was for the U.S. benefit and interest in the Middle East. That's why they funded Israel. What did the world do? They've been negotiating with Israel for the last 48, 49 years. And I think the Americans will do the same. If they are serious about this, if Trump is not bluffing, and he has shown us several times that he's not bluffing, if he's not bluffing, the U.S. will go and occupy that. And it's not only Greenland. He mentioned a few other islands that America has interest on, like they've done in Yemen and others. They will go and occupy it. And the world will go to the UN and sit in the UN for the next 4 years that Donald Trump is in power. Maybe the worst person will come after Donald Trump, and these negotiations and engagements will continue. That's how the U.S. run the world. They keep them busy in the UN office in negotiations. And those who don't want to be in there are stubborn. They attack them militarily.
So in a nutshell, we are screwed for the next 4 years.
Well, that's what people are saying. I think we
are waking up.
I think we are waking up to reality that democracy is demon crazy. It's craziness. There's nothing democratic about this whole process that America has been telling the world that democracy is the best. They are not democratic themselves. And the world has bought into that. They even have U.S. aid-funded projects to push democracy, to make the world be like the USA. You understand? And they're not democratic. We have come to reality. And when some of us say we like President Trump, people think we subscribe to his ideas and his madness. No, we don't. We are simply saying he is unsettling.
The world isn't a world needed a shake up.
It needs a shake up. We need a change in the world, good or bad, but we need a change, and change is important.
I mean, for instance, when you look at the rhetoric that especially the Republicans spew, I'll give you an example where trans prisoners are now being sent back to male prisons, for instance. But they'll use words like, we're here to fix this wokeness. It's almost like someone had an issue with the fact that there's political correctedness and we're going to fix it by any means necessary.
Yes.
Regardless of what the consequences may be, regardless of what the collateral damage will be, because we refuse to be woke, because we refuse to be bullied by the woke social media gang, we're now going to... It's almost like saying we're going to muddy the waters.
I think
because
that's
you
approach.
Think clean water is woke.
But you know what I like about all that?
Yeah.
It's that it's in America for the Americans. They are not imposing that to other countries and to the world. And a majority of these controversial bills that he has signed into law or directives that he has issued, they are mainly domestic majority. So the Americans have put President Trump and the Republicans there with their clear policies. His message during the elections was very clear. It was not unambiguous. You understand? It was very clear. And let the Americans eat the cake.
Sure.
They deserve that cake that is in front of them. Let them enjoy it.
And it might be brown, but it's not chocolate. Let's wrap up in the DRC.
Yes.
M23, Rwanda, the DRC. There's even talk of the Israelis might be involved because there's no way the M23 can be this machine with just basic arms. And that, in fact, that a sophisticated machinery means it comes from somewhere.
Yeah.
And there's even speculation that Kagame has a relationship with Netanyahu. Like, there's a lot happening there.
Hey, Fresh, you know this forms a sad part of my career or my life.
In fact, your demo, what's it called? Your career as a diplomat started in Rwanda.
No, it was the second one.
Was it the second one?
My highlight. I call it the highlight of my career.
So you set up the diplomatic office in Rwanda.
I established in 2001. I was based in Kigali.
Yes.
I established the South African. I was the chargé d'affaires at interim, acting ambassador. You know, because there was no ambassador. I established the relationship, and one. At that time, I was also covering. Now this is interesting for me.
Yes.
I was covering Burundi, Bujumbura. because we had no, so I was accredited to both countries.
Sure.
Two, I was covering the Eastern DRC. Mm. At that time, the RPF, Rwanda Patriotic Front, had just occupied the now disputed eastern part of the DRC.
Yes, the mineral rich.
Yes, Goma, the Goma area.
Yes.
At that time, the relationship between the RPF, Rwanda Patriotic Front, led by President Paul Kagame, and the then president of the DRC. You remember, it was just a few months when I was stationed there that the previous president was assassinated and the son took over in the DRC. I just forgot the Kabila.
Kabila, yes.
Yes.
Lohan.
Yes, and then the elder Kabila, who was assassinated, was put into power by Kagame and Museveni before Kagame was in power in Rwanda, because he was exiled in Canada, then the U.S. studying there. But most of the RPF forces were stationed in Uganda.
Yes.
So Uganda played a pivotal role for the government to come into power in the DRC. But the story that went along the lines when I was there was that Kabila started not touring the line of what was agreed upon.
Yes.
And that's where the battle and the conflict started, when they felt that Kabila has betrayed them. You understand? Regarding pushing out the Belgians and the French and guarding the mineral rich. So it's all about minerals. So they were, we will help you, Kabila, to remove Mobutu Sese Seko and the others, but once we get into power, you will help Kagame to come into power and will push the colonialists out. The same thing that is happening in the Sahel region with Mali, Burkina Faso, and Equatorial Guinea. The same thing that's happening there. That was the grand plan of Kagame and Museveni in there. But the DRC Kabila came into power in the DRC, and Rwanda occupied the Goma area.
Sure.
I remember fresh vividly, there was even a curfew. We couldn't, you know, I couldn't execute my duties in that region because of curfews. But when President Kagame was asked for, over the years, people are saying he's funding the MP23 or he's supporting them. Nobody has ever come with any sort of material evidence.
But the UN have even stated that categorically, Rwanda is supporting M23.
How can they put it on the table with how, with which arms? And I'll come back to the Israel issue. What President Paul Kagame said, he said when the Rwandese moved, and that was the yesteryear, when the Rwandese moved to occupy that site, some rebels who ran away from Rwanda when RPF, the ruling political party, took over Rwanda, some of the rebels from the previous regime of Rwanda, they ran into the DRC, and therefore the DRC government of Kabila at that time was funding them in order to come and topple the government, to cause chaos in Rwanda. And that was his reasoning at that time, that that's why he's got the Rwandese forces in the eastern part, to protect his own country against the rebels that the DRC is housing them. That was his reason. And nobody has ever come and provide, and as far as I know, any material evidence. Let the, you know, the law says the one who alleges must provide evidence. Let them provide evidence how they did it. But now moving fast forward, the MP23 group or rebels or whatever they are called.
M23, yes.
Yes. They are said to be, and this is where the link, people are linking them to Rwanda or to Paul Kagame.
That are Tutsis.
They are Tutsis who speak, or there are people who speak Kinyarwanda, even if they are not Tutsis.
Okay.
The official language in Rwanda is called Kinyarwanda.
Sure.
And the same problem now goes back to what colonial borders. It's the same as in South Africa, if I make a quick example, where you have in the northwest, in Mahikeng and Lihurutse, Botswana, who we can trace our roots in Kanye or anywhere else in Botswana.
Yeah, so you have Barolong on either side.
On either side, yes. You understand? We understand. Now, due to the colonial borders, these Kinyarwandas, the same as Basotho in the Free State and Lesotho, they are claiming, and these are said to be the M23 rebels, they are saying the central government of the DRC does not want to recognize them and to allow them to manage the rich mineral resources of the disputed area, which is the Goma area. You know, there's two lakes feeding the Goma. Lake Kivu is running into that area. So it's mineral rich. It's actually the richest part of the world. And now we can understand why there's a battle over the Goma area. It's the richest part of the world when it comes to minerals. And now they are the fact that they speak in Rwanda, and I don't want to say they are Tutsis. I want to say they speak in Rwanda because some of them may be Hutus.
Okay.
Some of them may
but majority are Tutsis. Though.
Majority are.
Yes.
But it's them who are complaining that the central government is refusing to. Rwanda is saying the fact that they speak in Rwanda does not mean they are our citizens or our people. You understand? Now, the world claims are these people, the military equipment that they have, some of it belongs to Rwanda. Some of it was funded in 2023, 2024. And this is a material fact. The EU funded the Rwandese army with drones, for example. And it is being said, it is being reported that some of those drones were seen being used by M23. That's where the link, how they got them, it's a story for another day that needs military experts and investigators. Some of the soldiers that fell in the battle last weekend, the M23 soldiers that fell in the battle, some were found to be carrying ammunition, arms, and even
uniform
and, yes. and what do you call it, bulletproof vests. What is the official word for bulletproof vest? It doesn't come. Bulletproof vests were belonging to the Israel Defense Force.
Yes.
Now you see where the link comes in. Sometimes the arms and the drones belongs to Rwanda, the government. Some they come from Israel Defense Force, and it is being said that President Paul Kagame has relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, which I doubt. And therefore Rwanda with Israel are causing havoc in the Eastern DRC. All I'm saying is, let's go back to the negotiation table. I know that President Ramaphosa had a telephone conversation with President Kagame this week. I know President Mbeki stood up. Remember, he was once a peacekeeper, especially during my time, because I served under President Mbeki in the Great Lakes. So he has also stood up to say, guys, let's go back to the drawing board. But it's so sad that first, sometimes last year, after I attended an event at UNISA at the Thabo Mbeki School, you know, I made a call, and President Mbeki said, "Wish before things get out of hand, because the war was continuing. But before things get worse, he thinks the two governments must start talking, meaning South Africa and Rwanda. So Kigali and Pretoria must talk because they are seen to be the superpowers in this. Now we come to why is South Africa being seen as a superpower in this battle? Because we've got the largest SADC deployment." Into the UNESCO, the United Nations one, and the SADC, you know, we've got the biggest deployment of the armed forces into the battle in the DRC.
Now, many South Africans are saying, hashtag, bring our troops home. What are your views on that?
It doesn't work like that. It's not only many South Africans, normal citizens. I've heard politicians who are, I'm so disappointed. I'd expected people like Herman Mashaba, I've heard them say, we don't even know why our soldiers are there. How did we get into politics when you don't know why our soldiers are there? They're supposed to be the first, you know. A general member of the public who is questioning why our soldiers are there, I would understand, but not political office bearers, because they pass the laws, they pass the rules. Then it means people do not know or do not understand our foreign service policy. Our foreign service policy, and being member states of SADC and of the AU, signatories to the United Nations Charter, which talks of peace and stability in the world. We are signatories to that. The laws that we signed, the treaties that we signed, require us, informed by our foreign policy, they require us to participate in some of these activities. And this activity, again, this is one thing that people miss. I'm not coming from the military. I'm not a military expert, but I come from the diplomatic, you know, international relations background. We are not in the DRC for a war, to fight. The UN doesn't send its people
it's
to
there
fight.
As a peacekeeping force.
As a peacekeeping force.
But obviously, if you shoot me, I will shoot back.
And
so are there for war.
No, Fresh, it doesn't. You simplify it. The purpose of peacekeeping force is to make sure there's peace, and innocent civilians and citizens, particularly women and children and the elder, who are unarmed, are protected. Because we know that whenever there's a war, most of the casualties is not the armed forces.
Sure.
There's almost 1.5 million people in the Goma area who were displaced in the past weekend only when there was this attack.
And, some will be here next week, car guarding.
Yeah. Mm. Yes. Mm. You understand? Now, that's the first element, to make sure those lives are safe. Mm. Our forces are there to say, like, and hail to them. Hail to our men and women in Kemo who are risking their lives to can go and save millions of lives in Africa. That's what a peacekeeping force and foreign policy informs. Mm. If we don't want that, if we don't like that, we must go to parliament and change our laws so that we don't participate. And we must also, the day we are under attack, we must not expect help from other neighboring countries. That's one element.
Who's going to attack?
No. I'm saying if it happens, I don't know. We don't know.
What, you think Lesotho might invade back?
No, Lesotho, we invaded Lesotho.
To revenge against Chief Buthelezi.
Don't bring back that story. You know, our followers will ask us, tell us more, what are you talking about? Don't bring back that story. Lesotho, we invaded Lesotho and we were well off. Okay, so let's leave that. But the second element that's very important in peacekeeping as well in foreign policy, Tato and the viewers, is that why are we doing this? We are doing this because it has been proven that when there's instability in the region, South Africa carries the burden.
Sure.
Most of the people from as far as, how many Congolese are in South Africa? How many Nigerians are in South Africa? How many people from as far as the eastern part of the continent, Somalia and Ethiopia, are in South Africa?
But being part of the peacekeeping forces not slowed down the influx.
It has not slowed down for other reasons. And reasons like we relaxed our immigration laws. The NGOs have taken the government for humanitarian reasons to court. Those are some of the reasons. But look at what is happening in Mozambique. If we were not playing our role in Mozambique for the last 2 to 3 years, the situation would be having more Mozambicans in South Africa. The situation would have been worse. So we have to have a synergy between government departments and arms of the state to be able to make sure that when we send peacekeeping forces, the end result, we see the benefit of having our soldiers there. And again, people are saying, but people are dying. My friend, let me tell you, my brother, when you are in a battlefield, once you wear the camo, the army, there is an unwritten rule there. One of your KPIs is death.
Sure.
It's an unwritten rule. That's what armies do. That's what. And once you carry an arm and you enter a battlefield, chances are you'll come back home in a body bag. Nobody wants our soldiers, our children, men and women in khaki and green and whatever camo, to come back in body bags. But that is part of being a soldier. That is part of being in the military. And I meet all these complaints. Did you hear the complaint? The government is silent. He's not talking to us. We know that on Wednesday, the minister addressed the public. But again, people are saying we took too long. The military doesn't work like that, Fresh. You know, people, South Africans are a very funny nation. People get excited. The government is quiet. Our soldiers are dying there. What should the government talk about when they're still waiting for the official reports in order to dish out correct information? You don't just, the military operates in secrecy most of the time.
Yeah.
And let me tell you the danger. I spoke to one of my former colleagues yesterday, who was a platoon leader, who actually was heading the South African peacekeeping mission in the South Sudan. I had a very lengthy conversation with him yesterday. And I said, bro, I'm very worried. The media and the public is pressurizing the Minister of Defense and the President to talk about what transpired in Goma. Yes, it was in Goma.
Sure.
They're not realizing that once we start talking to the media and telling the media what, we are actually exposing our soldiers more to go and say how many died, how many tankers were destroyed.
Not everything will get a press release or press conference.
Yes, some of the things the government cannot tell the people, because when you put things in the media, in platform, you are actually also informing the opponent.
Let me ask you a question. So, for instance, one of the families of one of the troops out in Goma was talking about how we are worried because the last we communicated with them, they told us, we assume over the phone or WhatsApp, they told us that they were under siege.
Yes.
Should they be even be having access to cell phones? Because that's also a security risk, surely.
a breach, not even a risk, because once there was that communication, yes, there's humanitarian communication when it's stable and quiet, that they can communicate with families. Yes. That's why until today, if you have noticed, until today, military personnel, when they are deployed, they still write letters to families, like the old days. It is for that reason that you don't take your smartphone and you put on WhatsApp and you start taking selfies when you are in a base, because that can be intercepted. That may end up in social media, you understand? And for example, that family, yes, they were saying that, but that soldier was ill-disciplined to do that, has risked his own life and the operation itself.
Sure.
Because now it's in the social media, it can be intercepted, and he has risked the whole platoon or the battalion that is carrying the operation. One of the videos that made rounds this week was the South African battalion or whatever commandos who were raising a white flag from a military heap or whatever. And first, it's some wrong information, because people who don't know military operations, they thought, oh, they are raising a white flag, that's surrender.
That's surrendering, yes.
No, they were not surrendering. That's that's not how it works. In conventional wars, once we are in the battlefield, and some of us have been in the battlefield, although not in conventional wars, when you raise in conventional wars a white flag during a skirmish or an attack or what, you are actually saying to the opponent, and I've used the word conventional very carefully.
Yes.
You are saying to the opponent or the attacker, you have destroyed my supply of water, medicines, and I've got casualties. Yes. I've got soldiers who have fallen. We will need to carry their bodies, or we need to carry those who survived, who are injured, to hospitals. That's what you are communicating. But fighting the rebels or
Because the fact that we're still trying to kill each other doesn't mean we're not going to be humane.
We're not going to be humane. Yes, you understand? This was,
which is the biggest irony, but anyway, carry on.
That's why I left the military and I decided to be a diplomat, because I've realized this doesn't make sense, that when I've got an AK-47 and my partner has fallen down, I must raise a white sakatuk handkerchief and say to the shooter, wait a minute, my partner has fallen. I want to carry him to the hospital and I'll come back to continue fighting you. That's how conventional wars are fought. But the war in the DRC is the economic war against the guerrillas or the rebels, and therefore they will not fight a conventional war. But I think the government has been communicating. I think the South African National Defense Force issued statements timelessly, and the press conference came 3 or 4 days after. But people must not just get too excited and think the government must tell us everything.
Absolutely.
The government, when it comes to secret service, as well as law enforcement and military operations, they cannot tell the nation everything. It doesn't work like that. You understand? It doesn't. What is said is when families find out in the media about the deaths of their loved ones. That is the sad part.
Absolutely.
But fresh, this happened on Thursday or Friday, on Friday or Saturday last week. By Sunday morning, the South African National Defense Force had issued a statement. And for me, there was no delay. And that statement was fully detailed, you understand? And the minister went on to brief the people. Look, we have lost, you know, and condolences to the families of the lost, you know, peacekeepers. And they are not only majority from South Africa, you know, 14 so far, one from Malawi and others from, you know, there was even a UN. Because there's another worry. Okay, this is my other concern in closing this one. I do not know if we were serious about peacekeeping in the DRC. Why do we have two peacekeeping forces? The UNESCO, the United Nations Military Operation and Peacekeeping in DRC, it's sitting somewhere in the north part of the country. And South Africa has forces there as well. Then there's the SADC one, there's SAMCO, something like that. It's sitting at Goma, which is the disputed part. Why, if we mean peace and we want to show unity towards this, why didn't we have a UN force there? Only one force. The UN force, under the UN umbrella.
Sure.
Because countries that are purported to be supporting and being involved there, like Rwanda, that are alleged, they are part of the UN.
Sure.
They play a role. Rwanda is playing. And why would Rwanda go and support rebels against the UN and against SADC in the DRC while they are sitting in the northern part of Mozambique supporting SADC and the UN to bring peace there? It doesn't make sense to me.
No, because politics don't make sense.
Well, or minerals don't make sense. There's no minerals they want in Mozambique.
Exactly. I think on that note, Botsang, let's leave it to everyone else. Please comment, share your views, agree, disagree. Any interaction is welcome.
No, thanks, my brother. Yeah, I want to see this. You know what I want to propose?
Yeah.
I said to you last week, I don't want a diplomatic posting. I think President Ramaphosa must just send me to Kigali to talk to President Kagame.
Sure.
I've done it once. I'll do it again for the peace in this sub part of the continent.
President Ramaphosa, he is your man. He's done it before.
I will go running 3 months.
He'll do it again. Botsang, thank you very much. Where do you find you online,
Thank
brother?
You very much, brother. FreshBotsangM@gmail.com. And it's at BotsangM on social media handles. And BotsangM, it's 082485-9100 on WhatsApp.
Thank you, as always, for tuning in, for interacting, for being a part of WOW, What a Week, hashtag Politrix. We are part of the Africa Podcast Network. Email us at waw@africapodcastnetwork.com. Coming to you from AMP Studios, downtown Johannesburg. Shout out to Trevor and the crew at Pezulu Works for all of the cinematography, and to our executive producer, Giletso Modisa Geng. Till next week, have an incredible week in spite of yourselves.